Next session number 12585, Reel 2.
To Clayton, Reel 2.
That the defence of Crete depended entirely on the defence of these three airfields. So we had two Bovas at Malmi Airfield, and one of which was completely exposed in the middle of the airfield. And the other one was further to the east, on the edge of the airfield. And this one had some cover from view and a bit of camouflage. But the gun in the centre of the airfield was absolutely, totally exposed. It seemed to be a terrible decision to place it in such a position, which proved to be true, that it was attacked every day, and there was the Messerschmitt 109s and the Messerschmitt 110. Those ones all carried a bomb, a fighter bomber. So they had a strategy of attacking from three different dimensions at different angles at the same time. And the first ones to dive in a strafing attack, they would come over the hill which was to the south of the airfield, the hill known as Hill 107, Point 107. And this was out of, they would be in effect diving out of the sun towards the airfield, so that when the gun layers got onto target, they were being dazzled by the sun. But at the same time, the gunners would notice the firing from the left or right at the same time, and they would have to dive into the slit trenches, for they could do nothing against a simultaneous attack like this. And this happened every day. For I should have mentioned that when we went to Malmi, where we were positioned. Now, I've explained where the guns were positioned, but we had to have a headquarters unit with the... We had two officers, you see, and various sergeants and various other men who would have been predictor men and engine men for generators and so on. And they had Bren guns, and we were sent up the hill. So I was an orderly for one of the officers, and the other officer had an orderly. And I suppose altogether we would have numbered about 12 men. And we went up the hill, about three quarters of the way up it, rather on the eastern side of it. We could see Souda Bay from there. And so from this headquarters position, I was sent down each day to the airfield to be able to report to the officer on the general morale of the men. So I went down each day with some difficulty. And the men of Corporal Pace's gun, which was the one on the centre of the airfield, that they were getting very, very shell-shocked.
How could you tell?
They were very nervous, and Corporal Pacey showed me the bomb craters all around his gun, and on one occasion, He took me to see the gun layer seats, and these were in thick steel, and they were shot absolutely right through with armour-piercing ammunition. and one of the sights had been shot right off entirely. So Corporal Pacey appealed to me. He said, we can hardly fire back at all. He said, we can hardly let loose a few rounds. He said, they persist in coming three waves at a time from three different directions. It was a clever strategy, really, but it was quite merciless. From when we were in our position up the hill, of course, we noticed that they hardly got any rounds away. They hardly shot any rounds. From time to time, they would get a few rounds shot away, but then they would have to dive into the slit trench, for this strafing was enormous. We were being softened up, you see, ready for the invasion. We didn't quite realise that at the time. We just thought it was rather heavy bombing and strafing. For every type of plane came. High-level planes came with high-level bombing, pattern bombing. And Stukas came all day long in sevens. As soon as one seven had gone, another seven would come back and they would circle high and then peel off and dive almost perpendicularly. Now, there was another Royal Marine unit and strangely, we knew very little about it. It was so close to us, but one just couldn't get there at all. The important thing was to get to our own Beauforts and give them some support. And, but this other Marine unit was on the crest of this hill, a very dangerous position. They had 3-inch naval guns, and these could be depressed against sea invasion. But the Stukas had already turned those over. Well, they were quite exposed. And of course, they were a prime target, you see. So I don't know what casualties they had. Finally, the men on Corporal Pace's gun in the middle of the airfield, they'd fared so badly that Corporal Pacey had asked me to take one of his men back up the hill. He was completely shell-shocked, and in fact he asked me to replace him as an ammunition number, and I agreed, and the subject to the officer's approval that I would replace this man the following morning, you see, at first light. The following morning was invasion morning. Otherwise, I would have been on that gun as an ammo number. But the officer agreed to it. And usually, I used to sleep on the surface, usually, because although we were instructed to sleep in our slit trenches, such a lot of lizards and the occasional snake used to fall down on top of us. I used to sleep on the surface. But the morning attack, the strafing and bombing, started much earlier than usual, and I had to dive into the slit trench. Bombing and strafing was very, very intense. Absolutely, with no intervals at all. The fighter aircraft seemed to be making a point of trying to get the right angle to shoot into our slit trenches, and it was necessary to look upwards and see where the planes were coming from and dive into the opposite corner. and bullets would thud into the end of the slit trench that we'd just vacated. And this was such a cat and mouse game. And it seemed to go on for such a long time. Although I believe that when the parachutists came, I believe it was only about 7:30 or thereabouts. It seemed to be much longer, but the fear of being... Well, each man was alone in a slit trench, you see. They were like foxholes. They weren't a trench to hold several men. They held one man only. And when you wondered how the other men were and if they were surviving with Stukas dropping bombs as well as all this strafing and the Messerschmitts, the two twin fuselage ones, the 110s, they all carried a bomb, and they knew that we were in this particular olive grove, and they were really giving it to us. And then the object was to break our morale. But really, I think it made us bitter. I don't think any of us lost any morale at all. But suddenly we heard this very, very deep throbbing sound of very heavy engines. And I crouched lower, imagining that we were going to be bombed with something very much bigger than normal. I could only think of in terms of large bombers. When suddenly I heard the crackle of rifle fire, and instantly it occurred to me that parachutists were coming down. There was, for the first time, was rifle fire, crackling. So I looked up, and there the sky had many parachutists directly above us. And it was like lifting a weight from my mind, and I think all the other men thought the same. At last it was man against man, instead of against terrible machines. And the fear of being bombed to death or strafed, that fear was gone entirely, because their men were coming down, you see. And with no fear of their men at all, for because of this very heavy strafing had conditioned us not to care, you see. Such the relief to be free of strafing and bombing was such that it didn't matter about their men. And I jumped to the surface, and all the other men were jumping out of their slit trenches. And we were picking off these parachutists, and they seemed to be absolutely helpless. I think they were nervous, but there were very few of us. But we accounted for all of them.
How many was that?
Oh, my word, it's very difficult to estimate how many.
Scores?
More than scores, for I think 10 or is it a dozen came out of each plane, transport. And they seemed to come over in tens. There'd be 100 and then maybe another 100 in our vicinity. And the empty parachutes were littered all over the small vines in the vineyard. They were only about 2.5 feet high. And the men had no cover from fire.
What were you firing at them with?
Bren guns and rifles. And we virtually accounted for all in our vicinity. Now we had Bren gunners in foxholes around the other side of the hill, further away, and I believe they did great. They had great success.
What were your feelings like as you shot them?
Well, absolutely. really, we had no feelings of remorse. I didn't. It was relief not to be bombed, and the delight at being able to fight back at last. You see, we couldn't fight back against the Stukas. Our Bofors couldn't fight against the Stukas because they were harried by the Messerschmitts.
What do you remember happening next?
The area close to us had such a lot of parachutes which were quite still. The men were dead, all but an odd one, for we did capture one, who he lay still motionless for about 3 hours. And this must have been torture because it was really broiling hot. And suddenly he stood up on his feet with his hands held high, and we took him prisoner. If he'd moved around a little without doing this sensible thing of leaping up with his hands up, he would have been shot, as had happened to all the others. Any movement attracted rifle fire, you see. So this chap suddenly dived up onto his feet, sprung up onto his feet, reaching his hands high, and no one had the heart to kill him. We took him prisoner.
Did you come into close quarters with him?
We put him in a slit trench. And
what was his manner?
Well, he was very nervous, and of course he'd been through a terrible ordeal. He knew what had happened to his comrades, and he was within earshot of us, and he knew how close the enemy were to him. So he was in terrible morale. But just about that time, things were quietening down, and we heard the unmistakable sound of mortar fire. The mortar bombs make a very strange sound, a whinnying sound as they come through the air. And this scared us a little. And now all the mortar bombs came into our small, olive grove. And we had no cover from shrapnel because the trees were only very small, the trunks of the trees, not very thick. But very soon we seemed to scorn the mortars. They didn't seem to have any shrapnel at all. They were bursting up even on impact with the foliage of the olives. So the mortar shells were bursting in the olive trees high in the foliage. Leaves were showering down, and they were hitting no one at all. And a few of them got between the trees and hit the ground and burst. But still no one was injured at all. There just didn't seem to be any shrapnel. And within a short time, we were just completely ignoring the mortars. They seemed to have no effect at all. I suppose, of course, a direct hit would have, but they never achieved that. And this unit, wherever they were, well, it did worry the officers, because eventually somebody would have got a direct hit. But these mortar shells were falling constantly into the olive grove. And the officers were trying to work out where this mortar fire was coming from, but it was quite impossible. We'd not the slightest idea where it was coming from. The officer thought that it might have been coming from there was a small pine wood down in the valley, not very far down, and the officers thought it might have been coming from there, and he sent four of us down to go through this pine wood, but it was unoccupied. And I was sure it was unoccupied because earlier in the day a man had run out of there as if he were alone, and as if he were, it gave me the impression that he was frightened of being alone and wanted to contact a unit of his. And this would be only through guesswork, because he came out of the cover of the pine wood and he was going up the side of the hill opposite, where there was no cover of any kind. And, of course, he was shot down immediately. And we used to use him to gauge the range of our rifles, not his body, but to shoot beside him. We'd see the spurt of the soil, and so there was no one in this, no survivors in this pine wood. There was a few empty ammunition boxes, so they would have carried the trench mortars, and how they got those away without us seeing, I don't know. For they got those out into some position which we could not locate at all. And things stayed like this for, in fact, for most of the afternoon. Now, earlier than that,